Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Áine Curry here sitting in for Brendan. We're now joined by Irish tennis star Conor Nyland, who's written a book, The Racket, about his life as a pro tennis star, his time on the road playing Wimbledon in a historic moment for Irish sport, facing off against Novak Djokovic at the US Open and the sometimes brutal reality of the fascinating world of tennis. Conor, you're so very welcome here to the show and congrats on the publication of your book.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the very beginning, and your book starts with your parents. You come from a tennis family with your sister and brother, Gina and Ross, both playing. And, you know, you'd kind of talk about, if you're going to play tennis, having your parents involved as kind of a package deal. Talk to me about their role in seeing you through all of those hard years.
Yeah, I suppose you don't, as a five-year-old or six-year-old, tell your parents, I want to go and play tennis. Usually it's something that your parents get you into. And yeah, the opening scene of the book is me in Ballotieri Tennis Academy at the age of 16. I'd already had a lot of tennis under my belt at that stage, but I was training with the Williams sisters, and they obviously had their father, Richard, very involved as well. So I think you see that sort of pattern, I suppose, in tennis, where, yes, the player is the star, but often there's a parent that we know as well. You could even look at Judy Murray and Andy Murray. So yes, they're hugely involved. Financially, there's, you know, a massive burden, I suppose, on a family to try and make a tennis player. So yeah, they're very involved, even more so than most other sports.
And as you say, they're investing in this grand ambition from the age of five. But you talk about this horrifying gamble. Everybody invests the same amount of time and finances and resources and like dedication, but not everybody gets the same return.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the anomalies of tennis is that, like, Roger Federer was our first billionaire in the sport maybe 5-6 years ago. But once you get outside the top 100, the financial rewards kind of fall off a cliff. So I was in that crazy kind of position where I was an elite international class tennis player. My highest ranking was 129 in the world. But I'm, you know, obviously there's stories in the book. I'm building air conditioning parts in a hot sweltering hotel room in Russia at a challenger event. It's very unglamorous once you get outside that top 100. Now, I was in the unique position in that I was able to rub shoulders with the very best players, playing in the best tournaments sometimes, but then also going back to this futures and challenger world, which is a shoestring budget. And so yeah, it's showing that I suppose that difference between the very best and the guys just that little bit off, who've probably done the work that the top guys have, but maybe just a shade off, and that's the challenge.
And it's the finest of margins. I hadn't been aware of this phrase, tourists. You know, you can be out playing alongside the elites, but there's those in, you know, the top 20, top 50, and then there's everybody else. But it's the finest of margins. Do you kind of tend to know from even like age 12 if you're going to make or break it?
I think so. I think if you look at any of the top players, they're often trending from a really young age. And at the same time, there's still a window of opportunity, I think, in those mid-teens. And I talk about it a lot when we're at the Ballotieri Academy at 16. Myself and my friend Stephen Newton were over there for a couple of weeks. And within, you know, two courts, there was Serena Williams, Venus Williams, Maria Sharapova was there, Peter Korda, who won a Grand Slam, Andy Roddick. And then we were in it, and day by day, spending time with these guys, we were getting better and better. And we were based in Ireland. At the end of the 2 weeks, they said, listen, would you like to stay on? And we, for some reason, said no and went back to our lives back in Ireland and didn't maybe take that, as you say, that horrifying gamble of going fully into pro tennis, hedged my bets. I finished school, went to college in America, went to Berkeley. And yeah, maybe you need to go all in from that 12, 13 mark. Like, we were watching Sharapova train. It was the most intense training that I'd nearly ever seen on a tennis court, and she was 11 years old.
And that must be anxiety inducing. Like, when you're looking at you, you're still getting your opportunities, you're getting a quote unquote normal childhood, and you're looking across at that court going, well, that's what they're doing for her to succeed at 11. But it sounds like an anxiety inducing life.
Yeah, it's kind of all or nothing. And I think, you know, if you look at some of the team sports, you can have a pro career and take up, you know, say rugby at 12 or 13, if you've got the physicality naturally, you don't need to be, I was a kind of nearly a jaded pro traveling around at tournaments in the UK and Europe at 13. And that's me not even maybe going as full tilt as a Maria Sharapova, who had left, I think, Sochi in Russia was where she was brought up, and they went to the States and it went all in. And yes, it's a very international sport, incredibly competitive. There's a lot of people who want the same thing as you. And yeah, it's the players, I suppose, who are in the right environments doing it that intensely who tend to make it.
How steep is that learning curve? You know, you can be the best in Ireland in your teens and then you're stepping out onto the international stage. How steep?
Yeah, it's a bit of a wake-up call. You obviously will win a national event and maybe get on a trip to one of the big European events. And I talk about this in the book, going to the Les Petits Arts, which is the big kind of under-14 world event that Nadal has won, and Martina Hingis and all these great players. And I remember going over there and, yeah, just being amazed at the quality that these guys were almost like fully-fledged pros at the age of 13 or 14. And it knocks your confidence a little bit. But in some ways, I think maybe the fact that I only went to those events once or twice a year definitely could have been something we'd have done differently. Like, I think if you look at the top pros, a lot of those guys are playing 15 to 20 tournaments a year, even at 13 or 14 internationally, whereas I maybe was only playing two or three. So again, that's a huge ask of somebody and of somebody's family, right, at 13 or 14 to do that.
And when you compare and contrast, Ireland, obviously much smaller, not the same competitiveness when it comes to tournaments and opportunities. And you look at that international scene where there's just the systems and the whole legacy precedent for it. You were born in the UK, I think. Like, did it ever cross your mind that, OK, if I played for Team Britain, you might have had bigger, greater opportunities than sticking with Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, I would have potentially been in line for wild cards for Wimbledon. And, well, I would have been based on my ranking, and it certainly would have helped. But I made my Davis Cup debut for Ireland at 18. You know, I was born in England but moved back when I was three. It was always, it was never really a consideration. But in hindsight, it would have made a huge difference to me, obviously, to have that support. And I think it's one of the things I'd love to see in Irish tennis is a major tour event come back to Ireland. There was obviously the Irish Open, which was a pre-Wimbledon event for many years, which has fallen off the calendar. I think it would be amazing to have a kind of a marquee event in Ireland every June run up to Wimbledon. Doesn't have to be that time of year. And I think it would just sort of sit in the calendar. The press, the media could get after it. People could come and watch. We could get wild cards to our top players. And I think we could maybe build something off that.
So you mentioned Wimbledon, and it was always your dream to win Wimbledon, and then over the years it became, I want to play at Wimbledon.
Started to get pragmatic pretty early on that one, yeah.
And you got there, you realised that dream of it, and there's this moment in the book where you're sitting between sets and you're looking across at your family, and I think it's two sets apiece, and you have this moment, and you're recalling Gary, I think it was, saying to you, let's not be Irish about this, Conor. You've beaten these guys before. This is your level. And I wonder, what did he mean when he said, don't be Irish about this?
Well, we didn't have, I suppose, any role models to say, well, X, Y and Z has played Wimbledon. You can do it too, and guys to practice with. So I was a little bit, you know, the first to do it in 30 odd years. So I suppose, what did he mean, let's not be Irish about this? I suppose it meant go and win. Let's play Grand Slams. You're good enough.
Be ambitious.
I'd beaten guys who had played multiple Grand Slams over the previous year. I'd gotten to last round of qualifying, but wasn't kind of making that jump into the main draw. And yeah, I mean, I'll never forget that moment when I qualified for Wimbledon. Beat a Croatian guy called Nikola Mektic. And, you know, if you look at somebody who qualifies for Wimbledon, and somebody who wins Wimbledon, their actual reaction at match point is often quite similar. We all sink to our knees. That relief, that tension of almost a lifetime of build-up just goes in an instant. And yeah, it was an incredible moment. And then obviously got the opportunity to play Wimbledon. And I think what's so special about this book, and the opportunity for me was to be able to tell this story of the other side of the tour, the futures, the challenger life, and how hard that is. But there is still this payoff, I suppose, for the reader that they're able to experience with me what it feels like to play in Wimbledon. There's an entire chapter where I take them through that match against Mannarino, almost not shot by shot, but it was 4 hours long, but certainly in a lot of detail. And obviously going on then to play Djokovic at the US Open.
And you put down the loss, 4 hours of tennis, fifth and final set, you put it down to a lack of patience. Do you think patience can be learned over time?
It's ironic because my kind of natural inclination when I got ahead in a match was always to sort of batten down the hatches, make a lot of balls, not make mistakes. And we had been working over the last couple of years before that on being extra aggressive and trying to get on my forehand. And that's what got me over the line actually in the last round of qualifying. But then when I got to the 4-1 double break in the fifth against Mannarino to play Federer on centre court, I said, well, I need to stay aggressive. That's what's got me in this position. And I probably overcooked a little bit. And instead of rallies being 5, 6, 7 shots, they were 2 and 3 shots. I was going for a little bit too early and it just got away from me.
How often do you think about that fifth and final set?
It's been, twice this morning. So it's not.
It's every day.
It certainly was for a long time. And you know what? I think writing this book has helped. I seem to be thinking about it a little bit less. But it was an incredible opportunity. You know, I suppose when Wimbledon comes around and I'm looking at centre court, and then when I'm there, I think, I would have loved the opportunity to play. But I got to play on a main court at the US Open against Novak Djokovic, which definitely helped. It'll always stay with me. As somebody said to me after they read this book, they said, if it's for what it's worth, if it's any consolation, the fact that you lost to Mannarino has made this book a hell of a lot better. So, the reaction's been incredible. Obviously, it came out on Thursday, and the messages I've been getting from people saying what a great book it is, one of the great tennis books. It's really incredible to hear.
And is there always like a slight creative tension, contradiction that you're dealing with where you feel maybe, did I miss my ultimate potential there and grand ambition? And yet, knowing in your heart and soul, you did everything. You couldn't have tried any harder.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's sort of a paradox that I would say I don't think I fulfilled my potential in tennis, but I don't think I could have done anything more either. I think you're a little bit of a victim of circumstance sometimes, and with hindsight I know I probably could have gone gone to a tennis academy at 15 or 16 and been a better tennis player, but I think the way that I've done it, as I say, hedging my bets, but still got that experience of playing in the biggest tournaments, but yes, I definitely feel I left a little bit out there. I think if I'd been had a little bit more guidance, and we were learning on the fly, and I think you see that in this book, that there's, I was playing probably 40 weeks a year sometimes when I first came off the college circuit, because I felt like I was trying to make up ground, and not surprisingly ended up getting injured and probably a little bit burnt out as well. So I started to learn that a little bit more after a couple of years. But again, if I'd had somebody to say, listen, this is how you do it, you play these tournaments, it's 20 weeks, these are your training blocks. But I was sort of taking a couple of years. I started working with a nutritionist 3 or 4 years into my pro career, as opposed to straight away, all those little things.
And is there, like when you describe tournament to tournament, hotel room to hotel room, like you're just in training blocks, then you're in playing blocks. Is there any camaraderie? Do you build up friendships with these other sports elites, or is it a lonely existence?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit lonely. And I learned pretty early on that I was the only Irish guy at these tournaments, and the French guys and the German guys were going off to dinner together. I wasn't necessarily getting invited. So you see that on the tour, even with the very top guys, that they're bringing their own entourages, and there's 7 or 8 guys in a player's box watching them. They're creating their own team around them, because no, there isn't really any camaraderie, because ultimately we're rivals. Certainly on the Futures and the Challenger Tour, there's a phrase you say to somebody when you finish a tournament in the Challengers and Future Circuit, and it's see you somewhere, because you don't know when you're going to see these guys. It could be next week somewhere, it could be in 6 months. Your schedules are slightly different. So no, it is pretty lonely, and it's very much an individual sport. and guys aren't necessarily delighted to see you. You know, I remember there was a German player who used to get on pretty well with them. We were both playing a Challenger event in the States, and you know, mostly populated by Challenger guys. I remember this guy Simon Stadler said to me after a couple of years, "I'm done trying to say hello to these guys. It's been like 4 days. I've said hello to everybody I've passed. They haven't said hi back." They obviously don't want to see these guys coming onto their sort of circuit, this US Challenger circuit. So yeah, no, there isn't exactly open arms.
You realised early on that, you know, some of you were doing the see you somewhere, but the ones that could probably be nailed on to actually just, I will see you at the next tournament, yeah, was the Williams sisters. But you realised early on, because you were practising side by side with them, that Serena of the two was going to be the more impactful, record-breaking, history-making.
Well, my dad saw it. I didn't see it. I wasn't the most probably observant 15 or 16-year-old on that side of things. But yeah, Venus was probably the bigger star, you know, over those three or four year period. We started to hear about them when they were sort of 13 or 14. And when we were training with them, Serena was 16 years of age and ranked about 20 in the world. Venus was 18 and I think about 5 in the world. My late dad said, you know, after a couple of days, he said, well, he said, Serena's, you know, she's better. And I don't know if that was sort of the common view at that time. But yeah, it obviously was proved right. And Venus is still unbelievably still out there and playing and has had an incredible career and won Wimbledon's and all the rest. But yeah, Serena, obviously one of the all-time great athletes.
And you mentioned the fact that they're still playing. I think often with a lot of athletes, you know, you have an expectation maybe of retirement, you know, late 20s, but increasingly we're seeing the Andy Murrays, the Djokovic, like they're still going. And I suppose, when did you realise it's time to go here? It's time to sign off.
Yeah, I mean, well, what's interesting here is that a lot of the names in this book, and obviously my time on tour, say, you know, playing Grand Slams 2011 and finished in 2012, a lot of the names in this book are still out there. Djokovic, Murray, Nadal, Dimitrov, they're still playing, Venus. And for me, I had played Wimbledon US Open in 2011, but over the period, and I'll get into this in depth in the book, but over the previous year and a half, I had been getting cortisone shots. In my hips, I had had a lot of wear and tear in my hips. I'd had a bad fall in a tournament in Banja Luka in Bosnia that I talk about not too fondly in the book. And I've been managing that, and knew then after I'd obviously played the Grand Slams, I knew I was going to probably need to get surgery. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to be 31 this year. I've kind of done the couple of Grand Slams. I don't think I'm going to win one anytime soon. And yes, it would have been nice to try and play a few more, but I knew with the ranking system, if I took 6 months off to get surgery, I was going to have to start back, build back up at the Futures and the Challenger circuit. And I just wasn't quite able for that. And did end up getting hip surgery, but not coming back on the tour.
When you look at Andy Murray, I think age 37 now with a titanium hip.
Yeah.
Do you think it's sensible?
I don't think it's made for what he's doing to it, that titanium hip. So I don't know. I'm sure he's got, you know, good medical advice, but he is always been shown to be very much his own man. So whether he's getting advice and sort of not listening to it, I can sort of see why he's doing it. And maybe this is going to be his last Wimbledon and get a sign off. But he's still giving himself a chance to be, you know, playing at these big occasions, and maybe he can make a third or a fourth round at a Wimbledon and give a good sign off. But amazed to see him still out there, and Djokovic as well, the same age now, getting knee surgery or just had knee surgery at the weekend. So they're starting to creak these guys a little bit, but still incredible longevity.
Do you yourself play at all now? Are you encouraging your kids into the sport? Are you becoming now what your parents were? You know, shouting instructions.
Try not to shout. No, but I play a lot? Not really. If I am on court, it actually is usually with my kids. You know, they're very small, 5 and 7, and just starting the journey. But I think a lot of ex tennis players probably know a little bit too much. And you know, again with the Williams sisters, even my parents, my mum had played sort of, you know, not socially, she played sort of a national standard, but my dad was a Gaelic footballer. And again, I think the fact that sometimes not knowing a process allows you to get into it a little bit more readily. I obviously know a lot, and it's all written out here in this book. So We'll see. If they're incredibly keen on it, then I'll certainly support them. But they're playing loads of sports, so we'll see.
So you're not going to be the pushy parent.
I'll try not to be.
And is there ever parts of you, like when you look back, nostalgic for it now? Do you miss it? Do you miss the adrenaline, the crowds, the attention?
Well, every time someone hits a drop shot on TV and I'm watching, my whole body sort of shoots towards the TV. It's very weird, like a kind of a dog after, you know, the bell has been rung. So it's always, it's still in me. That instinct is still there. I'll always be, you know, even when I'm, you know, much older even than I am now, I'll still probably feel like I'm a tennis player, certainly an ex-tennis player. It's in me. And yeah, it's... when Wimbledon rolls around and the grandstands roll around, you'd love to obviously be involved, but I've made peace with that. I had my run and glad I got to experience it at all.
What advice would you give to young listeners this morning, parents who are ambitious for their kids when it comes to sports like this? You know, you often hear sports stars just talk about it's consistency of effort. It's not about high performance. What's your grand takeaway after all of these years?
Yeah, my takeaway is to do it right. If you really want to be, you know, a professional tennis player, don't be one foot in and one foot out, because what will happen is you kind of fall between two stools. And, you know, as there's a Indian tennis player, a guy called Purav Raja, said to me once, he said, you can't be Roger Federer and Albert Einstein. And sometimes I think in Ireland, you know, kids are out playing tennis and football and looking for sunder in the leaving and playing the violin, and you know, you can't do everything. So if you're going to do it, go all in.
Okay, great advice. Thank you for that. Conor Nyland, author of The Racket, which is out now. We'll be back after these.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.